Good morning. So good to see all of you. We've missed you all fiercely. I bring to you greetings and aloha from the Big Island of Hawaii, where Annie and I and our two kids, we traveled around the four congregations there and preached and connected and fellowshiped with the Christians there and returned with their blessing to you. And we also enjoyed our time there so much as we met many Alaskans that were also over there at the same time. And from there, I came back here for about a day and a half before I went down to Texas to meet up with Jeff as he purchased a vehicle. And while we were down there, we had the blessing of getting to participate in the AIM graduation ceremony and getting to connect also with our AIM students that are currently there, Joseph and Josh and Kaya and Kenna, and to encourage them to see how they've been growing in their preparation to going out into the mission field, and to honor Trisha and Emily and Kinley, who just graduated from the AIM program, and getting to thank God for all the fruitfulness that was done through their service. And from there, Jeff and I took his new truck to drive up to Canada, and also in that truck we had with us a few bags that Kinley, who just came back from Mexico, asked to bring back with us. And so, Kinley, we have your bags here. We got in last night, thankfully. But as we were driving, I was just kind of joking with Jeff, just looking ahead, that we're going to be crossing the border in a few moments or a few days. And I just got to thinking, you know, Jeff, if we get to the border and they ask us if all this is ours, you know, honestly, we're going to have to say some of it's not, because we have these few bags in here from someone who just came back from Mexico to Texas. We don't really know what's in them. And if we're at the border, we might have an awkward moment if someone asking, are those yours? No, whose are they? Our friends. Where are they from? Mexico. And they told us to bring them to Alaska, to them. And so we'll see what happens. And so we didn't have too many problems at the border, but Kinley, we have your bags. And so we're excited to bring them. Also in Lubbock, we had just a wonderful, not coincidence, but a connection that James and Andrea were able to connect with some of the churches in Albania, and two young ladies were attending the event at the Camp Adventure from Albania. And so just between the congregation here in Alaska, Texas, Mexico, Albania, just the whole world, it's just there's a lot of threads that the Lord has woven from this place out into the whole world, and just seeing a snapshot of that these last few weeks was very encouraging. And with all that in mind, I'm just thrilled to be back here with you and to be working alongside you in service to our King. So we're going to be concluding our series of looking through the Gospel of John today. We've been looking at the seven signs of the Gospel of John to understand who Jesus really is. That's the purpose of the whole Gospel of John, is for Christians to understand that Jesus was sent from the Father, that Jesus is God, and that by believing in Jesus and that him being sent from the Father, that we can have eternal life. And so we're going to be looking at the seventh sign that John specifically highlights for us to understand that Jesus was not just a good person, but that he is sent to earth by God, from God, and he is God, and for us to understand the mission of God that includes us. And today, the final sign in the Gospel of John is the resurrection of Lazarus. And we're going to see that not only is this the resurrection of Lazarus, it's a sign pointing to the resurrection of humanity. So we're going to be in John chapter 11. If you have your Bibles, please turn there. I will also have the scriptures on the screen for us to read. But this sign, this moment of Christ resurrecting Lazarus, is one of the most iconic miracles in the Bible. It's become represented in people's writings and fictions and other, it's inspired so many concepts. The word Lazarus has become completely intertwined with the concept of resurrection in other literature and other ideas. And it's such a dramatic historical moment where a funeral gets interrupted with life. And this is arguably one of the most potent, miraculous signs that Jesus performs in resurrecting his friend Lazarus. So This is also, I'm finding, an ever-relevant truth to reflect on, that humanity in Christ, death does not stick. And with Lauren and with many other of us that are suffering with different physical conditions or different unknowns on the horizon, that having to grapple with our mortality as humans, seeing this historical moment of Jesus calling life out of death is ever more inspiring to us. And so let's dive into this together and let it not just be something interesting we think about, but a truth that we can believe together. So let's go in, verse 1, chapter 11. Let's get the context for this beautiful moment. Now a certain man was ill, Lazarus of Bethany, the village of Mary and her sister Martha. It was Mary who anointed the Lord with ointment and wiped his feet with her hair, whose brother Lazarus was ill. So the sister sent to him, saying, "Lord, he whom you love is ill." But when Jesus heard of it, he said, "This illness does not lead to death. It is for the glory of God, so that the Son may be glorified through it." So here we want to understand that Lazarus wasn't just some guy. He's specifically friends with Jesus, which will be important as we understand the story. But also we want to see it that there's purpose in the pains that are happening here, that Jesus intentionally has purpose in allowing certain difficult emotions to be experienced. So let that be a backdrop to this setting, that there's purpose in the pains of this life. We then see, continuing on verse 5, that Jesus loved Martha and her sister and Lazarus. These are people that Jesus loved. So when he heard that Lazarus was ill, he stayed 2 days longer in the place where he was. Then after this, he said to his disciples, "Let us go to Judea again." The disciples said to him, "Rabbi, the Jews were just now seeking to stone you. Are you going there again?" Jesus answered, "Are there not 12 hours in the day? If anyone walks in the day, he does not stumble, because he sees the light of this world. But if anyone walks in the night, he stumbles, because the light is not in him." After saying these things, he said to them, "Our friend Lazarus has fallen asleep, but I go to awaken him." The disciples said to him, "Lord, if he has fallen asleep, he will recover." Now Jesus had spoken of his death, but they thought he meant taking rest in his sleep. So remembering back from a few weeks ago when we were going through previous chapters where Jesus heals the man born blind, that Jesus caused quite a stir there at the temple and in Jerusalem, and hostility between the Jewish Pharisees and the teachers, the scribes, and Jesus was beginning to mount, and where if anyone was to associate with Jesus, they're going to get kicked out of the synagogue. And so there's this tension building that they're looking to kill Jesus. They're looking to eliminate him. And we see, as Jesus is talking about Lazarus to disciples, that his timing seems to be confusing. He waits a couple days and then goes, and he's talking about Lazarus being asleep, and his disciples don't really get it. And this is an example of Jesus speaking in a way cryptically. That was a kind of a pun there for cryptically talking about ha, 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 ha. If you don't laugh at that, laugh at this, that the disciples aren't getting this. I love this next verse. Jesus then told them plainly, "Lazarus has died." He's saying he's falling asleep. I'm like, if he's falling asleep, he'll wake up. And they weren't getting it. They weren't understanding what Jesus was saying in his cryptic language. And so he just cuts the chase and just tells them plainly, "Lazarus has died." And I love that we have a Lord who can speak plainly if he needs to. If we're not getting it, he can meet us where we're at, even if that's sometimes way down here. And that we have a Lord who can speak plainly if need be. Well, verse 15, we see that, "For your sake, I'm glad that I was not there, so that you may believe, but let us go to him." And we're starting to see a dynamic here where we need to trust that Jesus has a more developed sense of purpose and timing and justice than we do. That Jesus knows what he's doing, and what he's doing is better than the way we think things ought to be done. So verse 16, we see Thomas called the twin, said to his fellow disciples, "Let us go, that we may die with him." Because they know how heated things are back in Jerusalem. If they go back to Judea, if they go back to this region, this is probably the end. It's that tense in Jerusalem. They understood that there was that much beef going on amongst Jesus and the leaders there at the time. And we see the zeal, and Thomas unfortunately gets the nickname Doubting Thomas, because after the resurrection, him saying, "I'm not going to believe that he rose from the dead unless I touch his hands and I touch his side." But here we see the same Thomas saying, "Let us go die with him." Like, he was all in. His fervor, his zeal was through the roof. He was ready to go. And I'm so thankful that our right standing with God is not based off of our own fervor and emotion and zeal, because that stuff is just a roller coaster. Sometimes it's in, sometimes it's out. But life is found in Christ, not in the consistency and the condition of your own current emotional mood. And so this day, Thomas was all in, ready to go die. Days later, it wasn't in the same place. I think of 1 John 3, verse 20, where that, even if our heart condemns us, God is greater than our heart, and he knows everything. Our heart is not the authority for our right standing with God. And that is a very good thing, because our heart is very whimsical, but Christ's life is eternal. And that is what our right standing with God is built off of. We see then that when Jesus came, he goes towards Bethany, that he found Lazarus had already been in the tomb for 4 days. This guy is cold. He is very dead. He has been in the tomb for 4 whole days. He is very, very, very deceased. So much so, we're going to see later on that there's a condition with that. Verse 18, we see that Bethany was near Jerusalem, about 2 miles off, and many of the Jews had come to Martha and Mary to console them concerning their brother. So when Martha heard that Jesus was coming, she went and met him, but Mary remained seated in the house. Martha said to Jesus, "Lord, if you had been here, my brother would not have died." So we see the situation mounting, as this is not just between Mary and Martha and Jesus and his disciples, but there's now many Jews beginning to consolidate for this funeral, and that this is turning into a very public setting, which is going to be very important as we're continuing in this narrative. This is an incredibly public event that is Lazarus's funeral. And we're going to see a question posed a few times during this, and I hope you see that it is a very relatable question of, "Lord, if you had just fill in the blank, if you had just been here, then this wouldn't happen." And that type of thinking, that type of grieving is very, very natural. And we're going to see it appear multiple times. And I hope you see it as relatable as I do. It's, "Lord, if you had just filled in the blank." But we see that there's faith here with Martha. "But even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give it to you." And even in that grief, that confusion of like, "Lord, if you had just been here," there's this backdrop to the pain of knowing that Jesus and God are completely unified, and Jesus still has all authority, even if you don't understand what's going on. And this is an important example for us to understand, to bring your pain to Jesus, even if you don't fully understand what's going on. This is probably going to happen several times for the next few months, where I'm going to refer back to this week-long truck ride with Jeff, because there's a lot of great conversations between the two of us, and just really great memories. So a lot of illustrations and examples probably going to come to the surface from that. One of them was, we were thinking about the Psalms and how the Psalms are so expressive, and they're so important for us as Christians to learn how to talk to God. And many of the Psalms have some brutal, vengeful language of, "Break their teeth, God. Let them fall into their own pit. Draw your bow. God. And there's this type of smite and wrath where they appeal to God for justice, and it's like understanding that vengeance is yours, Lord, but here's some ideas. And what we see here is this grief, this pain of, if you had only been here, but I know who you are. And I think that's a very relatable and something we need to grasp more of, bringing the grief to Christ, but remember who you're talking to. Bring it to him, bring your question, but remember, even now, I know that whatever you ask from God, God will give you. So bring your genuine questions, your pain, your confusion, your anger, but bring it to the one that you know who that is the Lord. Well, Jesus said to her, "Your brother will rise again." And Martha said to him, "I know that you will rise again. I know that he will rise again in the resurrection on the last day." I want to make a quick point here just to point out that the idea of resurrection, bodily resurrection, was not something introduced after Pentecost and in further Christian teaching. But here with Christ on the earth, already the idea of a resurrection was something that his disciples were not only aware of, but were in fact believing. But Martha, though, is missing something here, where she's thinking of the resurrection as almost like a cosmic event. Like there's going to be an eclipse. There's going to be like this moment in the universe where there's this day, and at that day, then this cosmic event's going to take place where there's going to be a resurrection. And Jesus clarifies that in a profound way, where you see it's not an event, it's a person. Jesus says to her, "I am the resurrection and the life. Whoever believes in me, though he die, yet shall he live. And anyone who lives and believes in me shall never die." The resurrection is not a moment in the future. The resurrection is Jesus. The resurrection is the person of God that was standing on earth 2,000 years ago and continues to exist to this day at the right hand of the Father. He goes on to say and ask her a very important question. Do you believe this? I want to ask you that question as well. Do you believe this? Ask yourself that question. Do you believe that Jesus is the resurrection and the life? That there is going to be a time in which the dead are raised, but that it's not just a time. There's a person that is the catalyst and the source of that resurrection, and it is Jesus. Do you believe this? We're going to see that even in believing this, which I hope many of you do, I know many of you do, that even in believing this about Jesus, that doesn't disconnect you, and it shouldn't disconnect you from the grief of this world. She said to him, "Yes, Lord, I believe that you are the Christ, the Son of God, who is coming into the world." And this is just the right attitude to have, to believe who he is and to believe what he's doing, even if you don't fully comprehend all that he is doing. He's doing more than we're aware of. We can only see the tip of the iceberg of the work of God. When she had said this, she went and called her sister Mary, saying in private, "The teacher is here and is calling for you." And when she heard it, she rose quickly and went to him. Now Jesus had not yet come into the village, but was still in the place where Martha had met him. When the Jews who were with her in the house consoling her saw Mary rise quickly and go out, and they followed her, supposing that she was going to the tomb to weep there. I found this motivating, looking at this passage here, seeing the promptness of Mary answering the teacher's call. And by being prompt, by being quick, being proactive in receiving the call from the teacher, going at once to go meet him, that the crowds, the people around her, followed her and helped connect to Christ to witness the power of God. And I find that to be one of the best examples of how to be evangelistic, to be outreaching and bright to your community, is to be prompt to the teacher's calling. Don't be slow to answer the call of God, but be prompt. And the people around you will notice that, and you will help lead them to an environment in which they can see the works of Jesus. And so let's listen to this passage here and be motivated by this to be prompt to our master's calling. We then see in verse 32 that when Mary came to where Jesus was and saw him, she fell at his feet saying, again, the same phrase we read earlier with her sister, "Lord, if you had just been here, my brother would not have died." That same natural response of grief. We currently understand grief to really have five stages or really kind of facets that don't necessarily have to go in this exact order, but they're all components of grief, and that is denial, bargaining, sadness, anger, and then acceptance are all packaged into this thing that is grief. And grief tends to be proportional to love. And we see here almost a sort of bargaining and sadness and anger with Mary that, oh, here's this pain, here's this loss of the person that I love, and if only this had happened, then this wouldn't have happened. And that's that type of process that she's in the middle of this deep grief, and she's bringing it before the Lord. And then from this setting right here, with this Mary and Martha and this crowd, and this conversation, this next passage is one of the most significant scriptures to gain insight into the heart of God. I hope that we have our attentions here as we look at this next passage to see in a profound way the heart of God. When Jesus saw her weeping, and the Jews who had come with her also weeping, he was deeply moved in his spirit and greatly troubled. And he said, "Where have you laid him?" They said to him, "Lord, come and see." And Jesus wept. He weeps. He's troubled. He's deeply moved. The one who has all knowledge, the one who has made everything, the one who is perfect, he's experiencing and being exposed to the fruit of sin. He's being shown the consequences of a fallen world that is death. And there's a difference. There's a difference between knowing about something, accepting something to be true, than seeing something first hand. Many of us know of the conflict going on in Ukraine. Many of us know about the different conflicts going on in the Middle East and in Gaza. If one of us was to go there for a week to the front lines or to the hospitals or to the people there, do you think you would have a different perspective on some of these things after being there in person? Many of us have been in very dark, death-ridden environments where sin has caused much suffering. And there's a difference between accepting something to be true to being exposed to the carnage of it firsthand. And Jesus is being surrounded by grief and the effects of sin on a world that he made. And he's weeping with these people that are weeping. He faces and feels all the darkness of death. And he even knows he's going to bring life into it. But knowing he's going to bring life into it doesn't disconnect him from experiencing the grief in the center of it all. And this is something so important about Jesus, and something we are to also imitate, is that he is not detached from this world. He conquers it. He steps into it. He doesn't detach and go a different direction. He goes straight through it. And he conquers death with the life that is in himself. I think of Hebrews 4:15, that we do not have a high priest who is unable to empathize with our weaknesses, but we have one who is tempted in every way just as we are, yet he did not sin. Jesus is completely and perfectly relatable. He has experienced everything we could ever experience and was faithful through it all. He knows what it's like to lose someone he loves. He knows what it's like to go through this life and all the suffering that is baked into it. And yet he did it faithfully. And that's why he is perfectly relatable and he is worthy of following. He's done it all and he's done it all right. I think also of Psalm 56 verse 8, we're told, talking about God, that he has kept count of my tossings, put my tears in your bottle. Are they not in your book? That he understands. He's not just aware of the suffering of mankind. He's right there in the middle of it. And from what we just saw in John, he's not just respecting the tears coming out and setting them aside. It's like, this is a special thing. He is weeping with us. He's weeping with his friends. He's weeping with his creation. And we have a God who not just only weeps, he weeps with you. As you go through your grief and you experience your loss and your suffering, even though he knows what's about to happen, he knows he's going to solve this. He's going to change. He's going to cancel a funeral. He knows this is about to happen, but yet he still experiences the depth of the valley of the shadow of death right there with us. He completely knows you and experiences with you, goes through the same journey with us. And I think that is an incredibly comforting thought. We then see that the Jews said, "See how he loved him." But some of them said, "Could not he who opened the eyes of the blind man also have kept this man from dying?" We see that some get it and some don't. And I wrote here in my notes, don't be an armchair quarterback to Christ. If you see Jesus doing something, you don't understand why he did it. Don't just like, well, he should have done this. Take him as he is. See him as he is and trust that he knows what he's doing. Verse 38, Jesus, deeply moved again, came to the tomb. And it was a cave, and a stone lay against it. And Jesus said, "Take away the stone." And Mary, the sister of the dead man, and said to him, "Lord, by this time there will be an odor, for he has been dead 4 days." We see here Jesus now, this stirring that's in him, this grief that he's experiencing within him, he's now being moved to action. And I think of several passages all kind of coalescing in this moment. I think of earlier in the Gospel of John, chapter 2, verse 17, where he drives out the money changers and the animals in the temple, where he says that zeal for my Father's house consumes me. And I think that connected with 1 Corinthians 3:17, where we're told that we are his temple, and that whoever destroys the temple, God will himself destroy. And likewise in 1 Corinthians 15:26, that the last enemy to be destroyed is death. And we are his temple, and God has a desire, zeal for his house. Lazarus is his friend, and death has killed his friend. And just as he cleared out a temple and flipped tables and drove away thieves, he's going to destroy the destroyer. He's going to have zeal for his house, which is his people, because we are his temple. And I just imagine him looking at that stone of that tomb, "Take away the stone." That same zeal of wanting to flip a table, "Get this out of here. This is a problem, and I'm going to solve it because I have a zeal for my house. This is my temple, and it has been defiled." I think all the way back to Genesis 3, where this promise is made of towards Satan, that you're going to bruise his heel, but he's going to crush your head. And this is Jesus starting to lift up his foot, about to stomp on the last enemy and show that death is vulnerable to him. We then see Jesus said to her, "Did I not tell you?" Talking to Martha, "Did I not tell you that if you believed, you would see the glory of God?" So they took away the stone, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said to the Father, I thank you that you have heard me. I knew that you always hear me. But I said this on account of the people. I said this on account of the people standing around, that they may believe that you have sent me. You see, they obeyed. They didn't understand what was going on. Martha was afraid that it was going to stink. It was going to be dishonorable. Or it was going to be a problem. But she did it. And that's a huge, important lesson for us to understand that we don't need to understand everything that's going on. We need to believe and we need to obey. That they went and took away the stone, not knowing exactly what was going to happen. And that's why obedience comes first. Understanding comes later. And we also see here that this sign, this miracle, this is for all of us. This isn't for that Jesus is praying this and helping us understand that what's about to happen, the reason why he waited away for a few days to let Lazarus die, for this event to happen, that he's praying in this public way, the purpose of this is for us to understand something, for us to see the oneness between Jesus and the Father, and understand that Jesus was sent from the Father for a purpose. And here comes the climax of this entire chapter, and often in many ways, this gospel. When he had said these things, he cried out with a loud voice, Lazarus, come out! Can you imagine the suspense and the drama of everyone in the crowd looking at an open tomb? And I imagine quite softly, slowly, quietly, they hear a shuffling. Can you put yourself in their shoes, witnessing this profound moment that the man who had died came out, his hands and feet bound with linen strips and his face wrapped with a cloth? Remember, this is a public event. There's many people here, and they just witness a funeral get canceled and a man walk out bound with these that has been dead for 4 days. I imagine as a Jew, this is an incredibly head-scratching moment with all the different rituals and statutes for dealing with dead bodies. Do you run and give him a hug? Is he dead or is he alive? What do we do? And what you do, I'll tell you what to do. You do with the one who just called a dead man to life. You do exactly what he says to do. And he tells them, unbind him. It's funny he has to tell them to do that. Unbind him and let him go. And this is where we see the authority of Jesus. He has authority over death. He has authority over all. And you do what he says, and they go and unbind him, and they let him go. You do what the one who just called the dead to life, you do whatever he says. I think back to Mary, Jesus' mother, back at the wedding at Cana. She said, whatever he says, do. And now coming full circle at the end, at this funeral, where they unbind the once dead man. You see, this, the words of the true king were spoken. What he says goes. He called a dead man to come out, and he came out. And Jesus calls the dead to life, and then he calls the living to freedom. The man came out alive, but he was bound, and then he says, unbind him and go. And he does the same for all of us, where he calls us all out of death into life and then on to freedom. Now, there's public significance with this moment. Remember, the Jews and Jesus were at odds with each other, where there's a profound implications of what just happened, where Lazarus is now a walking sign. He is a walking testimony to the power of God, where he was once dead, but is now alive and walking, talking. It is such a profound thing that in your own reading, I hope you look at this. The next chapter, chapter 12, verses 9 through 11, the Jews plot to kill not only Jesus, but they also plot to kill Lazarus because his just mere existence is such a powerful testimony that Jesus is not like anybody else, that he is sent from God. And if you like to geek out about these things like I do, archaeologically and historically, the Christians of the area met at the tomb of Lazarus from this day onward. And they never had to dig up the tomb of Lazarus because people met there all the way until now. There's been five churches built on top of it, one mosque, and that the tomb never actually got buried because even in like around 300 Eusebius, one of the early church fathers, wrote about how Christians still continue to meet there to that day, that the tomb of Lazarus was such a public and profound turning point in recognizing who Jesus is, that this was a real place, and that a funeral really got canceled. And this is such an important fact, and if there's anything from the lesson that you retain, I hope that it is this powerful fact that the resurrection of humanity is real. It's not just an idea. It's not just a theological result that we just did an equation. Like, well, if Jesus said this and did this and made this happen, and there's this kind of metaphor, and maybe conceptually we'll have an existence ever onward. But there was a dead physical person for 4 days in a tomb that Jesus was friends with and told him to come out, and he came out. That it really did happen. It's not just an idea. It's a fact of history that there was a funeral canceled by Jesus because he called his friend back to life in a public manner. And it was such a conundrum for the region that they wanted to put Lazarus to death. And that you and I, as we face our own mortality, that friends of Jesus don't stay dead. And that's something you and I are promised. And Lazarus is a proof of concept. He's a sign that his resurrection from Christ is a sign to us that friends of Jesus don't stay dead. That death doesn't stick for those who are in love with God. So are you his friend? Are you friends with the teacher, our Lord, the King of the universe, Christ? I wrote down here as part of my conclusion that we will weep together and then never again. But without Jesus, there's only a place of weeping and gnashing of teeth. So if you're friends with Jesus, take comfort in knowing that you will be with him always, as Ben read for us earlier. And that's something we all have to go through, it seems, unless Jesus returns during our lifetime. But that death is something we go through and then past and then into life ever onward. And that with Christ, we weep together. We need to weep. We need to grieve and experience these things. But know that through Christ, there's a conquering of this death. And that Jesus is the destroyer of death because he is an unquenchable life. So take comfort if you are friends with Christ, knowing that death is not the end. I think often of C.S. Lewis's writings in Mere Christianity, that this life is simply the cover page of a never-ending story in which each chapter is better than the one before it. And that's the type of life we experience in Christ, that death doesn't stick for those that are his friends. If you are not friends with Jesus this morning, if you not have entered into friendship, eternal friendship with him through baptism, you can begin that friendship right now if you desire. If you are friends with Jesus, take comfort in knowing that there are tears to be shed at times in this life. There are some things worth crying about because we imitate our master who at times wept, but know that that weeping is not forever. So take comfort and know that there's a master who weeps with you, and then will go on into a life in which there will be no more weeping. The physical resurrection of humanity is not just something we hope for, it's something we have seen and we hope for. And that's something we get to participate in because our God calls us to life. And I hope we answer that call promptly, and that's an example to the world around us to see that there's a call to answer. So I hope we all answer that call promptly today and for every day onward. Let's stand and sing this next song that we've selected.